Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to an event this morning that promises to be interesting and quite likely controversial, and where I'm sure the discussion between the panelists and the audience, and perhaps even among the panelists, will be lively. I'd, of course, like to welcome our panelists, our six panelists, for being here. And some of them have come a long way from out of D.C., and we appreciate their willingness to be with us this morning. Thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to start by asking a number of questions, and to say before that that there are two certainties going into 2009. One of them is that we will have a new administration in Washington, D.C., and the second certainty is that we will have a drawdown of troops, of U.S. troops from Iraq. And the question that arises then is, should Iraq continue to be a foreign policy priority for the new incoming administration? I ask that question because there are indeed many in Washington who now place Iraq low on the priority list of the United States foreign policy interests. And the arguments for that are very interesting. Of course, there is the argument that Iran is more important, Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda are more important, not to mention Russia, the economy, and so on. And therefore, in Iraq, we have to lower our engagement and our commitment. And the other arguments, or counter-arguments that are made, is that, well, we have one in Iraq, we can declare victory, and therefore we can disengage. There's another camp which says we cannot win in Iraq. It's hopeless, and therefore let us disengage. So there's a lot of debate in Washington about, is Iraq still important enough for us to remain fully engaged, fully committed, and in what ways? I would like to suggest a number of reasons why Iraq is still important for the United States and why it should continue to occupy the attention of the new inhabitants of the White House. The first reason is location, location, location. So long as Iraq is not going to change its geography, then it is important for the strategic interests of the United States. Iraq is the neighbor of Iran, and so long as we have difficult relations with Iran, and so long as Iran continues to have an interest in Iraq, therefore the United States should continue to have an interest in Iraq. The Iraqis don't want to hear this. They do not want to hear that our policy towards Iraq is in many ways linked to our policy to Iran. But I think that realistically it is very difficult for the United States to disentangle those two issues, although there are many ways of dealing with them, but we cannot think of Iraq without thinking of Iran, and we can't think of Iran without thinking of Iraq, and we can be sure that Iran, in thinking about the United States, is not thinking also about Iraq, and also, as it thinks about its strategies in Iraq, is thinking about how this impacts its relations with the United States. So both Iran and the United States think of Iraq as integral to their policies towards each other. This is one geography reason. Another geography reason is that Iraq is at the center of the Gulf and the Middle East and cannot be insulated from the myriad problems that exist in that region. So long as the Middle East and the Gulf region are of importance to U.S. strategic interests, Iraq cannot lose the attention of the United States. A second reason is oil, based on proven reserves, not on new exploration, but on proven reserves. Iraq is capable of producing 6 million barrels of oil per day. Now, given the situation in the oil market, given the need for energy, not only by the United States, but across the world, Iraq is an important player in the oil market, important player, therefore, in U.S. security interests worldwide. and to have Iraq as an ally of the United States is an important consideration. The third reason that I would state is the question of unfinished business and U.S. credibility. For better or for worse, whether we agree with the military venture in Iraq or not, the U.S. has pegged its prestige and credibility on a good outcome in Iraq, however we define that good outcome. And that prestige and credibility is particularly vulnerable in the region, and it would be very difficult for the United States to walk away if it is seen walking away with unfinished business. So finally, a stable, reasonably democratic Iraq is essential for U.S. regional interests. Now, the further question, if we accept those assumptions, is that if the administration believes that Iraq should have a high priority, the question arises for the new administration of, so what can the U.S. do? What does the U.S. need to do in Iraq to produce that desirable outcome or to help a good outcome in Iraq? And furthermore, does the U.S. have the tools? Does it have the leverage in Iraq to make a difference? There are many voices in Washington that say we have no leverage. We have no more tools. And as we draw down the forces, we have even less tools. We have asked our panelists today to look at these questions and to assess the institutional and political progress in Iraq, to find out where we are in Iraq today, and to suggest what is needed for Iraq to move forward in a positive direction, and to make recommendations on how the new administration can help in that movement in the positive direction, what tools it has, and what policies it should develop in order to help Iraq. I will moderate the first panel, and my colleague Dan Serwer will moderate the second panel. I will ask each panelist to speak for 15 minutes, and at the end of each panel, we'll have a Q&A. And I'm hoping that for about 10 or 15 minutes towards the end, there can be questions not just to the second panel, but it'll be open to all the panelists. I'd like now to introduce our panelists. One of them, as you can see, is still missing, but we're hoping that she will be here soon. But our first panelist is Qubad Talabani. Qubad serves as the representative of the Kurdish regional government in the United States, and he has been in that position for a number of years now. Qubad is, of course, very familiar with Iraqi politics and has been engaged in Iraqi politics for since before 2003. He was, for example, the PUK's top liaison to the coalition before 2003 and as the coalition transformed into the Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA. He was PUK's chief negotiator during the drafting of the transitional administrative law, which was the TAL, the first Iraqi interim constitution. Qubad studied in London and holds a bachelor's in mechanical engineering. I will introduce Nesrin Barwari when she arrives. Let me move on to Judge Ra'ed Juhi. To many of you, probably Judge Juhi is familiar from television. Judge Juhi was formerly the chief investigative judge of the Iraqi High Tribunal, the court which investigated and tried Saddam Hussein and other former regime leaders for war crimes and genocide in Iraq and crimes against humanity. Judge Juhi served as the investigative judge for the newly formed Iraqi High Tribunal. And in August 2004, he was appointed as the investigative judge for the IHT, specifically to investigate the crimes of the former regime. Pursuant to that, Judge Juhi referred for trial the former regime figures on charges in Al Dujail case, as well as the Anfal case against Saddam Hussein and his co-defendants. Judge Ra'id also led the effort to draft the IHT's rules of evidence and procedure, and he was instrumental in drafting the law that was adopted by the Iraqi National Assembly, formulating that court. In 2007-2008, Judge Ra'id was a USIP fellow, and currently he is at Cornell University, where he is the first Clark Middle East Fellow. I can now introduce Nasreen Barwari. Hello, Nasreen. Ms. Nasreen Barwari was the Minister of Municipalities and Public Works in the government of Iraq from 2003 to 2006. Prior to that, she was the Minister for Reconstruction and Development in the Kurdish Regional Government from 1999 to 2003. So you can see she has had a long experience of executive authority, particularly in reconstruction issues and so on. Nasreen was a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics in the spring of 2006. She received her bachelor's from Baghdad University in architectural engineering in 1991 and graduated from Harvard Kennedy School of Government in public policy in 1999. Currently, Ms. Barwari is completing a PhD program at the University of British Columbia, and her topic, interestingly, is rethinking decentralization as the pathway to democratic governance. Thank you very much all for being here. This panel will specifically address the issue of institutional progress in Iraq and the building of the state's institutions and where we are and how we can move forward on that level. Thank you. I'd like to ask the panelists to come to the podium to speak. Apparently that helps the cameras. So, go back.
Thank you, Rand. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back at USIP. Unlike some of my colleagues who have come a very long way to attend here, I've only walked one block to come here, so it is always good to be here. Institution building is a critical issue for Iraq, and I want to tie institution building to what we consider what should be our guiding principle in the country, which is the country's constitution. These are two fundamental issues that are intrinsically linked together, and they both need each other to succeed. Institutions need to be governed and regulated by law, and a constitution is only as good as the institutions of state that exist to uphold them. But rather than this be a chicken and egg scenario, the constitution must always come first. Unfortunately, in Iraq, what has slowed real political and substantive progress is a lack of adherence to or understanding of Iraq's constitution. The constitution, while far from perfect, is the only national compact we have right now. Our constitution is full of holes, and like yours in the United States, is open for interpretation. But it's still the only law of the land. The irony of a constitution is that it is both a living document and a forceful document. And while it can be changed, and ours can, and must have such means to amend it, it must be strong, forceful, and must be able to stand up to temporary passions of emotion. It must be able to unflinchingly defend and protect national interests as outlined within its pages. The U.S. experience, as in other nations with federal and national constitutions, help us see how this can be accomplished. The U.S. Constitution is a marvelous example of this. The Constitution was amended, for example, to give women the right to vote and the lowering of the voting age to 18 years of age and to ensure that non-whites had the right to vote. It is still a living document and changes every day. But in times of national challenge, such as the Civil War or the Great Depression, or the populist challenges to the national government in the 1890s and 1900s, the document held firm. It was and is the key basis for national unity, as well as individual freedoms. And all institutions in this country have flowed from that. While we have a constitution, we still lack a shared vision of what Iraq is and what it means to be an Iraqi. It really boils down to, will this country be governed by a strong centralized Baghdad, or will power be devolved to the regions and provinces, not just on paper, but substantively? While the constitution defines Iraq as a federal and united country, we see the federal government in Baghdad today trying by all means to reassert its dominance over the entire country, at the expense, I might add, to state, provincial, and regional rights. When we as Kurds see the Prime Minister of Iraq send Iraqi army units to the peaceful town of Khanaqin, of which its citizens are over 90% Kurdish, without the knowledge of the general staff of the Iraqi army, I might add, thus raising tensions and forcing a standoff with Kurdish units that had been requested to protect those areas in 2004 and 2005, Kurds see a reemergence of an ideology that totally disregards state institutions which were designed to prevent such unilateral decision-making process. When we see certain leaders in Baghdad ignore efforts made by Iraqis from all walks of life to defend their territories, and through fear or more ominous reasons try to curtail the formation and integration of local provincial security forces, we see the old ways of centralized control re-emerging. When we hear Baghdad threaten provinces or the Kurdistan region that if we don't do this or if we don't do that, then our respective budgets will be withheld, we start to wonder, what kind of partnership are we in here? When we see time and time again key articles of Iraq's constitution, like Article 140, which deals with the important issues of disputed territories, ignored and time and time again kicked down the road, it reignites our fears that, like in 1970 when Kurds negotiated the autonomy agreement with Saddam Hussein, an agreement that unsurprisingly Saddam reneged upon, that we are taken for another ride. When we see national leaders in Iraq ignore Article 125 of the Iraqi constitution, which states that the constitution shall guarantee the administrative, political, cultural, and educational rights of various nationalities, including Chaldeans, Assyrians, and Turkmens, we begin to wonder how seriously people are taking this constitution. Some leading Iraqi politicians in the cabinet and the legislature appear to not know how to interpret this constitution. I wonder how many of them have actually read it. I also wonder how many of them know the true meaning of federalism and devolution of power and power sharing. Whether they choose not to know or their lack of knowledge is genuine, we may never know. Federalism and the devolution of political, economic, and security powers from Baghdad is mandated in Iraq's constitution. And the country's developing institutions cannot function effectively until we have this understanding across the board of where one's powers and jurisdictions lie. Division of power is one of the most challenging of all aspects of institution building. Who gets what and how does each institution use its power? One can write the most glorious document that ever existed, but it takes belief in power sharing to make it work. In the US, the institutions are cleanly divided between national and state and local. Often those lines get blurred, but it is eventually sorted out through proper channels. But it was not always easy. The Articles of Confederation were not clear on what institutions had what power, but it was peacefully replaced by your constitution. When the institutions of the federal government were illegally challenged by the states, a civil war resulted. On our national level, we have divisions of power between the presidency, the prime minister, and the legislature, and then, of course, the military and the different civilian departments. We then have the power preserved and guaranteed to the provinces and the regions, the cities and the towns. The Constitution stresses that the federal government has exclusive competencies in formulating foreign policy, formulating national security policy, formulating fiscal and customs policy. The key word here is formulating. It further states that any power not exclusively stipulated as competencies of the federal government are granted to the regions. This is a new concept for many Iraqis and for many in the Middle East. Power was wielded against most of us for so long. We are fearful of letting anyone else have it. We think our best interests are in holding all power, when reality, sharing it with mutual respect and mutual vision creates progress. We are now doing our sorting out of disputes, and in the end, just as in the US, the Constitution must prevail. Our cause is not lost. While possibly Iraq's most powerful political group, ISKI, has long and genuinely believed in federalism and power sharing as the solution to Iraq's question of identity, grassroots levels are now starting to understand this process more detail. Some may say that this was in fact an unintended consequence of the successful surge policy. Communities, while standing up for their rights and protecting themselves, are now beginning to understand the benefits of provincial powers and their rights. Recently, a delegation from Anbar came to the United States, and they were toured across Maryland, and they were taken to the governor's mansion. And they were very surprised by how ornate and beautiful this building was. And they said that a governor has a building like this. And they said yes. And they asked, how much does the federal government give Maryland to have a building of this stature? And the person taking him on the tour said, nothing. You know, the federal government spent some money on education and on some projects, but certainly didn't pay for this mansion. And they said, where did they get the money for this? Taxes. Apparently the people that were taking this group around saw in the eyes of this Anbar delegation a realization that working at a local level and a provincial level has significant benefits, not just in nice buildings, but in able to determine the development of that region or that province, and the development of not only of its education system, its health system, but also its infrastructure. This true awakening has caused heartburn to many in Baghdad that are salivating over control and dominance over the enormous economic wealth accumulating in the national treasury. And here is where things begin to become dangerous. Combine enormous wealth, a disregard for established checks and balances, and an increasing intent to overreach constitutional principles, and you have dictatorships in the making. I heard recently someone say that in the minds of every Middle Easterner there lives a little Saddam. Unfortunately, Kurds feel this way. As controversial as that comment may be, Kurds feel this way, because this is what we've lived under. And that is why we are insisting on our not-so-perfect constitution to be upheld above all. I was impressed that while recently attending a swearing-in ceremony for a good friend of mine at the State Department, I heard him state the words, "I swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America." He didn't say, "I want to defend my government, my party, my ideology," but it was his constitution that he was pledging to defend. I was saddened when reading our own constitution, which I do carry in my pocket. You have. I was saddened when I read in Article 50, which stipulates the oath that Iraqi officials take before taking up office, that it doesn't mention the Constitution, doesn't mention upholding our national compact. I long for the day that the rule of law, so lacking in Iraq today, reaches a point where Iraqis, whether Kurd or Arab, swear and mean to uphold our Constitution. It's comical and ironic that Iraq's Kurds, who by and large, since the inception of the Iraqi state, have opposed the state, its institutions, its constitutions, and today we are one of a few community that are upholding those very same things that we fought against and disregarded. What the next administration in the United States will take over is a country with an identity crisis, a country where its social society is emotionally damaged and its politics psychologically challenged. Rather than tell us what to do and tell us to set aside our differences and all be good Iraqis for the sake of national unity, the next administration should certainly help us build our governing institutions, but not just the buildings, but actually help us with the fundamentals of governance. They should help us fill those buildings with competent and professional people. The U.S., through exchange and training programs and partnerships, can help build the capacity for Iraqis to uphold the rule of law, to adhere to our constitution. The regional government's prime minister, Nechervan Barzani, has long said, Shiite Arabs fear the past, Sunni Arabs fear the future, and Kurds fear both. This statement could not be truer. It is these fears that the U.S. must help us overcome. It is these fears that create impasse on hydrocarbons law, on budget issues, on other outstanding pieces of legislation. These fears can only be alleviated with time and with experience and guidance from friends in the U.S. and elsewhere. The US mustn't allow Iraq's neighbors to stoke those fears as they have done in the past. When leaders in Iraq begin to realize that they don't need to be greedy, not just financially, but politically, and that there is enough of the political and economic pie to share across the country for the good of the country's 15 governorates and the Kurdistan region, and that federalism doesn't partition the country, rather unites a partitioned country, and that a market-oriented oil policy, not a state-run regime, is in the best interests of all Iraqis. And finally, it must be made clear to us that our constitution must be held above all other laws of the land. And then and only then can we have a viable state that we can call Iraq and a state that we can be proud of. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Qubad. I'd like to invite Ms. Shireen to the podium.
Thank you, Rand, for the invitation, and thanks for the United States Institute for Peace for hosting this very timely event. And as U.S. policymakers are attempting to decide whether to leave Iraq or stay the course in Iraq, 1 month before the U.S. election and almost more than 4 years after the transfer of sovereignty to Iraqi in June 2004, sorry to say that the Iraq situation remains fragile. Despite some shy progress on the security, there has not been sustained progress on the areas of governance, on participation, economic opportunities, services, and social well-being. Reports of some success in various areas are still beyond what need and should and could happen in Iraq. My talk today will touch on three issues, and I will try to use the time, the 15 minutes, although it's going to be very challenging. But because of my involvement in the first Iraqi government after the regime fall, and of course because of my background in working in rebuilding communities and contributing to the democratization process in Kurdistan, I will have to draw from that experience too. So my first section will be really looking at the what did we find when we went to Baghdad on September 2nd, 2003, and took up the position of Minister of Municipality and Public Work? And then what happened and what were the factors and actors who were playing an important role at that period? And what could we learn from that? Like what were the mistakes? What were the lessons? And then what has been achieved so far? What do we hear now as an achievement? And then I will end with some recommendations to the Iraqi government and the U.S. government. So thanks, Rand, for referring to my background. But as you could see, I started my professional life as a refugee in a Turkish camp, fleeing from the Iraqi planes in Kurdistan when they were fighting the Intifada in the north. I lived for 50 days in a Turkish camp. And that's what started my whole path in public life. Returning then working with the UN on relief and reconstruction efforts, so I really know what does it mean to become a refugee, what does it mean to become an IDP, displaced person, and what does it mean to feel safe and secure to go back and to my own village or to my own communities and then later to take advantage of the opportunity that a safety and personal security and political stability can offer a person to improve their life and feel their humanity. But then with the fall of the regime in Saddam, I served in three interim governments in Baghdad as a Minister of Municipality and Public Work, appointed by the Coalition Provisional Authority and under the guidance of the Iraqi Governing Council. I inherited a devastated ministry of 45,000 staff working in over 250 municipal offices across the country. Basically, the Ministry of Municipality was the most wide government institution that is represented in every township and urban center. And by being in township and urban center, they also represent the interest of rural communities. You would be surprised to know that in the first 2 months of my appointment, I did not have an office. Actually, it took us 2 months to be given, allocated at a building. And then it took me 4 more months to wait until that building is renovated. I spent 6 months of my first job in 2 rooms in a hotel in Baghdad. But I was more inspired when I walked in the building after they renovated it. Of course, I know about the building beforehand when it was allocated to us. But I was very inspired to remember that it was the same building that I was taken there as 14 years old to be integrated by security apparatus of Saddam, and then after that to put in jail for 1 year as a political prisoner because of my political family stand and affiliation. It's the same building that was allocated to me to be used as a base or as a center for the Minister of Municipality and Public Works. For 3 years in Baghdad, I had a reason to wake up every morning and walk in that building and help rebuild Iraq. And that kind of feeling that empowered me and helped me survive 3 assassination attempts. But this personal story is, I don't want it to take us away from what is the reality. The reality is that I inherited, just like any other colleagues of mine in the Iraqi government then, a devastated institution where buildings were damaged and looted and burned. So half of the first year we spent in rebuilding, gathering, grouping, but also working on re-inspiring the staff and reorient them and try to make them realize that the regime change is not only about the government, but it's also about mentality. What is our objective today after the regime change was not only to rebuild the country, but also to reorient our institution in a way we look at our role as serving the people and not serving the regime. And that was the major challenge. And it took a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of work also. The job is not done. But basically, we were busy in working on too many different levels, building our own institution so that we can serve in those buildings, but also providing services. I'm proud to say that within the first 6 months, we managed to bring services back to pre-war level. That doesn't mean that we improved the situation, considering, and that's something need to be kept in mind, that whatever the Iraqi government is inherited in 2003 was decades of neglect to public services and decade of damage to public institution and a bureaucracy that was strong in its setup but weak in its delivery. And that's what we had to work with. So working on restoring services, reorienting the organization, the institution, I call it organization because I think we have a role to do and an outcome to deliver. But in addition to that, we were able to also contribute to major changes, institutional reforms that were introduced by the regime change. One of them is really the introduction of the decentralized system. Our ministry was instrumental in working with USAID and other counterpart with the United Kingdom and other UN agencies in drafting the 71 order, which became the law for local government power and which designed the distribution of power, and then which was mentioned in the Constitution and became the pathway for that led to the provincial election and then the whole new setup of governance in Iraq today. But then also the ministry could be was able to react to emergency situation that came, like the security situation never stabilized and it continued to be affecting public services and indirectly, of course, affecting the operation of a ministry like a public work ministry. But I remember also walking into Najaf in 2004, September, fall of 2004, after the action between the Sadr militia and the American when they were pushed out of the city. And basically, it was a city of ghosts. And we had to go and try to first establish the sense of security so that people can go back. But then we went and talked to the religious leader there. I remember meeting Sistanis and others to convince them to play a role. And then I also can remember in spring 2005 going to Fallujah again for the same reason, because the area was cleared from terrorist action, and then we had to go. So our role and our work has always been hand-in-hand with the military in trying to, after clearing the security, then reconstruction. And that brings us to really the importance of security. And I don't want to talk more and add into the constitutional impact of establishing security and peace. But despite progress today that we hear about the surge and the success of the surge, but we have to remind ourselves, or at least I like to remind you, that let's not be cheated. The security of Iraq and the threat and the risk were not only solved last Thursday when the provincial election law was passed. We should not forget that the risks continue because of the past that we lived and endured. And until we solve some of the fundamental issues that are in nature political, but in practice, it also influenced the way the Iraqi government will design its institution. And I can bring the constitution, I can bring the distribution of power, the resource management laws, meaning the law, the oil revenues law, also the budgeting exercise. All of these may sound like issues of political agreements, but actually, in practicality, it takes institutions to implement and pacify the situation. And that's where we should never forget the role of the institutional reform and building. If I can just run through the history a little bit, it was the actually, after the action 2003, it was the different military representatives and the provinces that helped tie the country together. If we remember, it was a military action, and then many territory was beyond the interim government control, and the sectarian and ethnic forces were threatening to pull the country apart, and then elections were not yet foreseen, or at least were not scheduled to take place. So it was really at that point where the issue of empowering local governments and using local governments to provide peace, to provide security, to provide services that came about. And that, so it was almost like byproduct. I almost can say that I don't think it was the plan to do it this way, but it was byproduct. But then it became the, of course, with the adoption of the TAL and others, it became the motto of all Iraqi, at least 80% of Iraqi who support decentralization and the federal structure of the country. But actually, at that time, it was those military representatives, the U.S. military and other coalition forces who helped deliver. I can remember sending the budget through the military route, but also, of course, most of the budget in the first half year was coming from the U.S. government until the Iraqi restored its oil production. But it was that legacy that paved the way for the drafting of the local government law, for the provincial election in 2005, and then it led us to where we are. Now, what the interim government of Iraq did was they did organize and conduct a direct election with UN technical assistance, implemented the CPA 71 order on local government powers, and encouraged provincial council to take on budgetary responsibility by the time they were fully elected, set an automatic revenue transfers to provincial and municipal and district government based part on population, like even in the municipality ministry, we used to allocate a budget based on population. And then, of course, set up formal and regular and transparent coordination mechanism between the national ministry and the directorate general. That part, however, was always tricky and was always problematic because of that inherited culture of centralization that, unfortunately, we are seeing recurrent today. Even then, when I was in government, there are this tension. In a way, the Constitution has already adopted the decentralized structure. Already an order has been in use and generated local elections and local elected leaders, yet the government in Baghdad and the ministers were not willing to give away that power. And that tension continued to be. And unfortunately, we are seeing a reverse now, something to watch for. On the provincial council side, they would appoint the governor, the deputy governor, the police chief, and then they work with local directorate to develop their plans. strategic plans, and then they get the fund, and then they are responsible for the execution. And there is, of course, also an issue that I have. Even though we have set up the path for decentralization, unfortunately, I cannot see even today a transparent process of at least holding those elected people accountable. So we gave authority, we are transferring fund every year, huge amount of funds for people who were newly involved in this kind of role. And that's where we have a lot of issues of implementation, we have issues of corruption, and we have issues of ineffective spending. And that's an area I will come back to, where the U.S. should continue and maintain what they are doing. I know they are continuing to work through the provincial councils, reconstruction councils that they have, but at the end, I will really cry for that to continue. On the issue of good governance, different ministries adopted different ways of dealing with their reform institution, and that's another issue maybe of a risk or a mistake that was taken. Each ministry will design their own institutional reform without thinking of the whole picture, and then the Council of Ministers will have their own expertise and their own missioning and visioning exercise about the process. And I believe the process continue to be confused in that way. But at least in the Ministry of Municipality, we try to introduce good governance by promoting analysis and social examination of impact of services to prioritize, but also introduce a lot of new technical skills to run the ministry, and including networking the main offices in Basra and Mosul and Najaf and Baghdad with one network where we could share information and even have video conferences. During that period, of course, the United Nations also assisted in providing training and advised local councils, and also made public to the councils their funds. Now, if we want to measure Iraq reconstruction and see how successful we were, I would really do it in a very simple way. But then I will identify five areas that we should be looking at: security, governance and participation, economic opportunities, services, and social well-being. And I'm introducing a very simple way of asking how did we do. In terms of security, I want to ask everybody in Iraq the simple question: do you feel secure in your home and in your daily activity? The answer to that should give us, okay, the surge is successful, but let's be really down to earth and ask. At the end of the day, security means personal security and the feel of personal security. On governance and participation, do everyone in Iraq has a say in how Iraq is run? I challenge that. On economic opportunity, do everybody has a mean of income? On services, do everybody have basic access to basic services such as power, water, and sanitation? And then on the social well-being, do me and my family have access to healthcare and education? So with that, I think we don't need to look further. Of course, there are many reports who bring about massive progress, which is good, and we need to keep in mind that and keep the hope that, yes, the path is long, but there has been some achievements. And I was very happy to read, of course, different news about the development in the coverage of public services, of electricity, but it's still beyond what Iraq could do, especially when we know about the surplus of $75 billion. Why Iraq is still only have for 12 hours of electricity per day? Why still 56% of Iraqi people have access to clean water? Why most cities don't have sewage? Those are the same challenges I was dealing with, by the way. And those were the same problems that continue to be even after 3 years, after I left my position. Now, turning to where we are and updating ourselves, as I mentioned, some of the political issues that are now being debated and are on the verge of really affecting the whole agreement, let's say, that all the different parties has reached to in 2003-2004. But at the end of the day, it's really about how those political agreements can translate into actions in the ground. Without going, because I want to go to the really some of the major issues that I feel the U.S. could help. But of course, we have achieved on the provincial election law, but then I think it's not a complete achievement. The issue of this disputed internal boundaries, which maybe Qubad mentioned a little bit. The law, the oil law is still an issue. The constitutional review is still an issue. The whole ministerial capacity reform is still an issue. And then, of course, the anti-corruption efforts, which is very important. It's very sad to see that Iraq is third on the below list of, I mean, there's only Somalia and another country, Myanmar, that is below us. The internally displaced person is a massive issue, and it needs to be dealt with. And we need to take it as a criteria for safety and security if we really want to do something about it. Now, there are many indicators also that has been, you know, improved, like unemployment, agriculture, because of improved security. As I said, some more millions people are getting water, but it's still beyond what Iraq should have and could do. Now, briefly, what role could the U.S. have in Iraq? I think, of course, the U.S. still have a great role to play in Iraq in supporting and building the institutions. If it wasn't for the security, I'm sure the U.S. could have done much more. The security situation finally has improved. We hope that it will be improved. I don't think the U.S. will finance anymore, especially when we have $79 billion of Iraqi funds sitting in the banks. Even though the U.S. is involved in many worthwhile initiatives, especially on the civil society, which is a very good concept, but there's still more to be done, especially on energy reform, on the education. I think the U.S. could play an important role in helping reforming the Iraqi education. Health is important, but education is the basis. On the agriculture also, it could support the Iraqi universities so that Iraq could really take advantage of the potential of becoming a major agricultural production country. And then, of course, and especially when Iraqis can afford paying for it, I still believe that Americans should help Iraqis make best use of their money. Now, I won't talk. I had a whole 2 pages to talk about Kurdistan, but I won't talk about it. Hopefully, I will get some questions. Yes, exactly. But then I want to leave you with five, actually, things that I think Iraqis should do. I talked about what Americans should help us, but then it's really Iraqis who need to also do a lot for themselves. First and foremost, we should protect the agreement that Iraq is a multi-ethnic country, and Iraq is only Iraq because of the parts that it encompasses. There is no way of looking at Iraq. Iraq is composed of different people, and those different people need to feel respected and honored for who they are culturally, and should be able to feel safe and secure in their own country. So that's the general thing that we all need to really stress. But then, there are 5 issues that really Iraqi need to do. First, Iraqi issues need to be dealt with by Iraqi themselves, internally. There should be no external influence on what path Iraqi should take. This is an Iraqi issue, because no other country will accept interferences in their own internal affairs. That's one fundamental thing that Iraqis should commit themselves to. Second, as I said, any settlement, political or, political definitely, or security, it should take that the forces that were unleashed after the invasion of Iraq cannot go back together. The recognition of Kurdistan regional government and the federal relationship that it's enjoying now cannot go back together. The Kurds cannot accept less than that. Then the Shia dominance, and that brings me to the third point. Our Sunni Arab also should not fear being part of a new equation instead of being the dominant. These are three fundamental issues that can stabilize the security. But then Iraq should remain decentralized because it's the only way that we can achieve equality and participation of people. And then Iraqi government should really remove the reconstruction and development programs for the incompetent hand of the political people and put it into a professional, apolitical, and independent body. And that, of course, applies to the security too. Of course, the U.S. is very important for Iraq. No matter what the vision was, which was vanished because of the inappropriate and incoherent policies, but the potential for Iraq to be a strong country and friend of the United States continues to be. Year of 2008 is very important year for the United States. It's election year. 2009 is an important year for Iraqi. It's also election year. So we have a very important year coming ahead. Let's make 2009 a turning point, just like we made 2003 a turning point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nasreen. Let's move on very quickly to Judge Ra'ed Juhi. And
in the beginning, I want to say thank you so much for this invitation. And I want to say to my colleagues here, كل عام وانتم في خير وعام سعيد إن شاء الله. Happy Eid for you. And also, I want to ask Rand if I still have 15 minutes.
You have 16 minutes.
Okay, great. Stability and rule of law in Iraq, which is really it's two major points there. Because there is no stability, that means there is no rule of law there. And also, if there is stability without law, it's chaos at the same time. Both points, it's very important, and we have to work in this area is very seriously. My colleague is focused on the executive and administrative issues, but I want to focus on the rule of law there, because I believe without rule of law and without law in Iraq, we can't do anything, definitely. Under this umbrella, rule of law, there is many foundations, but the problem, most of these foundations working alone don't look to the whole picture, as Nasreen mentioned. There is Judicial Council, Iraq Judicial Council, there is Integrity Committees. I mean, when I said many committees, is not one. There is three committees there, and each one work alone, and I will go over there. And also NGOs, Iraq Power Association, universities, Minister of Interior, Minister of Justice. All these foundations work together as a legal umbrella. But how they work in the Iraqi situation, this is the question. They feel secure to work, they feel it's free to work, flexible. First thing is very important, Minister of Interior. After 2003, when they installed Minister of Interior, there is real problem in that time. How to rebuild Minister of Interior. Minister of Interior for all Iraq. To build this for all Iraqis together or for each area. They put the pace in that time to build area by area, which is now we face this problem. People working in Najaf, most of them from Najaf. People work in Diwaniya, most of them from Diwaniya. People working in Anbar, all of them from Anbar. Sadr city from Sadr city in Baghdad. This is the area, you know. That means, in other hands, in the future, there is real problem. Because if we move anyone from Najaf to Anbar, he can't work there. He can't work in Iraq. Anbar is based in Iraq also. But he can't feel secure because he's not from Anbar. Same thing for the people from Mosul. If I move anyone from Mosul to Basra, he can't work in Basra also because he don't feel free or relaxed and flexible to work there, because it's not from Basra. This one of the problems with the Minister of Interior, and there is many problems. One of the other one is corruption also. We still face the corruption Minister of Interior. As Nasreen mentioned, and I read this last week, really I feel very sad, because Iraq is the third country in corruption now, after Somalia and Myanmar. But thanks God, because last year we are number one. Yeah, that means there is improving. It's okay. Second foundation, judicial council, Iraqi judicial council. Rule of law without judges, it's very, 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 very weak. How many judges we have in Iraq? We have 1,000 judges and prosecutors. I'm really optimistic because the real number, it's 900 like something. That means we have one judge for each 30,000. One judge or one prosecutor for each 30,000 Iraq. In same time, we have one military guy for each 30 guys in Iraq. September 22nd, Deputy President Adel Abdel Mahdi mentioned we have 1 million security guys. Military, Minister of Interior, Al-Sahwa, that means we have 1 million person in Iraq with the guns. And Iraq now, and everywhere, it's 30 million. That means we have one in front of each 30. And we have one judge in front of each 30,000. This number, it's really make me confused a little bit, because we try to build rule of law in Iraq under this umbrella, military umbrella. Where is the power? With the military or with the rule of law? Because if I believe the military is moving on power in Iraq, that means I back to the square one, not in square two or three or four. Which is, I feel the security situation is improving and very good now, and I have to use this issues to improve the rule of law and this foundation in Iraq also. Anyway, I want to mention some numbers here, because I know exactly, we don't have full time to speak about rule of law, because rule of law is very big issues now if I talk about that. But at the same time, all the judges without security is there. All the law professors without security is there in Iraq. All the legal expert and advisor without security. We lost 33 judges and prosecutors from 2004 and 2008. And most of them is very, very educated and very powerful and very smart judges. And we spend years to raise these judges in Iraq. Last month, we lost the chief appeal judge in Rasafa, in Baghdad district, which he spent more than 25 years as a judge. And he's very smart judge there. Most of the our university, law school and our universities now empty from the our professors, legal professors. Most of the legal professors, they are working now around Iraq. Qatar, Egypt, Jordan, UAE. Just one example. Law school in Minister of Sharqa, law school of University of Sharqa, most of the faculty is Iraqi. From the dean, the small one, the last one. The dean is Iraqi. The dean is my professor. And all the professors there is Iraqis also. Law school minister in Sharqa University is running by the Iraqi faculty. We need these faculties. We need our professors in Iraq. It's not outside of Iraq. Because to build this country, to move forward, we have to have them there to educate our children and our youth. Also, there is integrity committees. Everybody knows about the public integrity committee in Iraq, which is very famous. But there is two foundations also working with this, but separately, alone. One, General Inspector Office in Iraq, and second, Financial Observer's Office. These three foundations, their job to face all the corruption. But each one of these work alone, without any link. As Nasreen mentioned before, there is no one look to the whole picture. If we can put these together and work together to face the corruption and let them move and mention all the mistake and corruption in the executive authority and the other places, which is good. But each one work alone, which is make their work is really like we can use it. We can use it because, you know, it is General Inspector Office send their report to the Minister's Council or any ministry they're running there. Financial Observer Office, same thing, just recommendations. There is not a real act there, except public integrity committees. They have authority to work with the Iraqi courts. Anyway, this little bit's background about the umbrella of rule of law there, which means is very big. Very, they have very huge job, but the problem how they work now. I mentioned most of the professors left, most of the judges worry and feel uncomfortable, insecure, as a personal secure, not as a security in general. Over all this, there is also many think is very good. This sometimes this issues is it's not negative, but the reality. But there is, in the same time, many positive points. After 2003, we established IHT, which is very important step in Iraqi modern history. Not because I'm part of this, no. But if you look to the Iraqi history last 50 years, it's very aggressive and bloody. But now, yes, we start with the rule of law. 1958, I will mention some years. 1958, Abdul Karim Qasim, he make the first call and he killed the king and his family in the same day. There is no trial, nothing. 1963, the first bad call. When the Abdul Salam Arif and Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr took the government, they killed Abdul Karim Qasim. Same day with his assistant and throw his body to the river. Same thing in 1970, same thing in 1979 when Saddam as a president, he execute most of his colleagues. And 1988, everybody knows about the Anfal campaign. And when more than 100,000 children, women and men, more than 4,000 villages destroyed. 1991, the biggest disaster, more than 200,000 of Iraqis killed there. And we have long list in Iraq. 2003, Iraqi High Tribunal established the rule of law. The first time we have real process for the rule of law. We have real trial and we have real legal process there. And we have rule of law. That's the first step to continue on this mission. But to continue, we have to have work together. All the umbrella of rule of law. Minister of Justice, Minister of Interior, Minister of Judicial Council of Judicial Council, Iraq Judicial Council, debatification, Iraqi Bar Association, NGOs, media. It's very important to Iraq. Because if they want to continue there, they have to believe rule of law. Because if they believe the militia or the military guys, there is no way to move forward. Yeah, 3 minutes is good. Okay, I will go to the solutions. We still face the security problem in Iraq. And people talk about the security is improving. Yes, I agree. But with the black, with the T-walls, with the 1 million of, I will say, people with guns, not guns, people. Yeah, people with guns. But we have to use this very good opportunity to work together. United States came to Iraq and gave them the guidance there. And now the Iraqi responsibility to take this opportunity and move forward. Iraqi opportunity in three ways. One, executive authority must be stopped to put their nose inside the rule of law and use the rule of law for the politician agenda. I will mention something here. One of the general director in the debatification committee, he had an interview with Al Sabah, with the morning newspaper, and he mentioned this article, as I think in 2006, August 10, 2006, exactly. You know, he mentioned the politician and the executive authority use debatification as a politics tool. You have to stop that. You have to believe rule of law. If I want to build my country, if I'm responsible for my country, for my children, I have to stop that. I have to let the rule of law's foundations work alone and advise me which is right, which is wrong. If we believe that, we can move forward. Second, we need to work with the Minister of Interior, Minister of Justice together and build them, rebuild them again as an Iraqi, not divided, depend on the area or city. No. And send the Iraqi feeling inside the people working in the Minister of Interior and Minister of Justice. We have a long way and very difficult, but we have to continue. That's our responsibility. I told to my students sometimes, you have to build your home, but this is your responsibility. But your neighbor and your friend will assist you and advise you and I'll help you. United States came to us and helped us and gave us the first step. But now our responsibility, as Iraqis, with our friends, to continue in our mission. Not divide our country, depend on ethnic or religious. No, we have to build this country as a one country, federal country. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. There are certain themes that emerge. I won't take any time, but it seems to me two issues that have emerged strongly is the fragmentation of institutions and policymaking and of executive procedures and processes, which has been a problem. And the other one is the tension between decentralization, the proposal for decentralization, the will to decentralize, and yet countervailing that, the need for some kind of national capacity in some areas. Let's open it up for questions. Michael. Yes, please line up to the mics. That's right.
Mm.
There are two mics at either side of the room. Yes, Michael, please go ahead.
A question for...
Could you identify yourself?
Yeah, Michael Gordon. I'm a new USIP fellow. I'm lead from the New York Times. I have a question for the panels. It was noted that there's an election in the United States this year and two elections in Iraq next year. And I have a question about an idea that's been broached in the United States for encouraging progress in Iraq. There's a widespread view among some in the United States that the withdrawal of American combat forces over a fairly short period, 16 months of the new administration, will be a catalyst for change in Iraq, that this will be a necessary prod that will lead the Iraqis finally to reconcile their differences and make progress on this whole panoply of issues, constitutional reform, all these very difficult questions that were raised here. There's a contrary view that extending the American combat presence as long as possible within the framework of the new agreement that's being negotiated would provide the Iraqis the security and assurance and confidence that they need to move forward. I'd like the panel just to address these two perspectives, what they think, would the withdrawal of American combat forces over 16 months help political reconciliation progress in Iraq, or would the continued presence of American forces encourage that?
I think anyone who would like to answer this. Probably all ladies first.
Let me take advantage of
new
that.
New Iraq.
Well, thank you for asking this question, because one of my talking points was about this, and you're giving me the chance to talk about it. The U.S. can play an important role in helping Iraqis achieve some of the obstacles that we are facing. But the problem that we're facing today, and I'm here, can I sometime talk from my Kurdish hat sometime?
Of course you can.
The problem is, nowadays, unfortunately, the U.S. are even acting like the former Baathists, excuse me to say this, in the way they are pressuring Kurds to accept some concession that are even against the Constitution. If the rule of law is the basic of politics, and that's the way it happens in the United States, then it should happen the same way in Iraq too, and the Constitution is the rule of law. So that's just an introduction of the point I wanted to make. But it is connected to your question. The U.S. withdrawal will be a disaster, because there is a lot of fear, a lot of hate, a lot of mistrust still. And it has been actually boiling now lately. So we just need to be very realistic in realizing the situation today. I know it may not sound good for the public opinion in election year, but as Iraqi, I'm concerned about my political stability and personal security. And the U.S. can play an important role in pushing the Iraqis and helping Iraqis to trust each other and forcing different, or at least forcing the neighboring countries not to interfere in Iraq too. That's the other role that the U.S. can play that is not playing. They need to play an important role at the regional level too.
Would anyone else on the panel like to answer this question? Sorry.
Reconciliation is, we have to understand reconciliation, you have to start from Iraq, not from outside Iraq. And I want to back with you, and there is panel here in June or July in USIP about the reconciliation in Iraq, and Mr. Rawandoozi is on the panel, and Omar Abdel-Sattar in that time. And Rawandoozi is talk about the steps for the reconciliation, but Omar Abdel-Sattar in that time, he's very clear. He said the reconciliation in Iraq just between the politician inside the government. This is the problem. That's one. Second, Iraqi constitution, any solution we are looking for should be came from the constitution. Iraqi constitution never allowed to any Baathist come back without, under any name. And that's very clear title and very clear article in the Iraqi constitution. And the reconciliation with who? Sahwa now is part of the government. Before, Sahwa it is fighting with Al-Qaeda against the Iraqi government. And now Sahwa, they will be ready for the election. That means they are part of the government. Sunni part of the government, Shi'i part of the government, Kurdish part of the government. Reconciliation with who? with the all the old regime. Who's the old regime? Equal Baptist. The Constitution mentioned no Baptist. That's one. Second, the withdrawal. In one word, big chaos. That's it.
Sorry, very briefly,
it's a difficult balance for the U.S. to strike between by issuing this announcement of withdrawal or an announcement of withdrawal, making sure that different Iraqi groups and the different military units that still exist in Iraq don't hedge their bets out of fear and insecurity to go and find the person with the biggest gun and side with that person. Which would be a disaster for the country, and at the same time, you know, making sure that people are just not lulled into a false sense of security to say that this the wrangling and the lack of political progress can continue ad infinitum. So it mustn't be written in stone, because nothing in Iraq is written in stone. It's good to have guidelines. It's good to have an idea of when we'd like to get things done. But I think people should be realized that everything should be and must be flexible.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, there is buttons on.
Could you try it, please?
Yes. I have three questions.
Very could quick. You please identify yourself?
Dr. Fail Badri, American Iraqis. I have three questions from the left to the right. First question, Mr. Raed.
Could you condense them into at most two, because we have a lot
second.
Of people.
Yeah.
Second. Okay.
About identification, Mr. Raed Juhi, during the first interview with Saddam Hussein, he doesn't pronounce his last name as Saidi, and I'm wondering why he didn't pronounce that name. I mean, our traditional, they proud of last name, and even in the hard way. What if they get it in the power way? So why did you pronounce the first and the last name?
Could I ask you to constrain your questions
question,
to the topics of the discussion,
question,
please? Thank you.
Question. When Saddam Hussein tell you the book you have under your hand, I wrote it, and you didn't answer him. Why you didn't answer him? And you still have the answer right now? Second question to Mr. Barwari. You
curiosity.
Mrs. curiosity about Iraqi's electricity and water, bad water. You like tell me that you are the wife of President of Bangladesh. That's your right. Your husband was a president.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. This is completely out of the subject we are discussing. Please, if you have a question that relates to our subject, please present it. I do not think the panelists need to be answering personal questions here.
Mr. Kubat Talabani, he dropped Iraqi word. His name is identification U.S. Kurdistan, U.S. representative of Kurdistan, Iraq.
No. The Kurdistan regional
region.
Government of
yeah,
Iraq.
What's Iraqi word?
Thank you.
I will answer. Don't
I really do think that we should confine our questions to what is pertinent to the event and to the discussion. Thank you. But
no,
if anybody,
second. I want to,
yeah.
Mr. Tai, I will very proud in my last name. But this is let me tell you something. You know, I am proud in my last name and proud of my father's name also. Juhi is my father. You know, and if you go to the any research about Ra'id al-Sa'idi, you don't find that. From the beginning, when I start my career, I mentioned Ra'id Juhi. And when I judge in Iraq under Saddam's regime, everybody knows my name is Ra'id Juhi. For that reason, but according to the American style here, they use the last name, you know. And this is my problem now. Sometimes people ask, where is Mr. Juhi? They said, we don't have Mr. Juhi's here. We have Mr. Al-Sa'idi's here.
Well,
and this is my last
thank
name.
You very much. Let's move on to the next question.
National Defense University. This is a question from Mr. Talabani.
Could you raise your voice a bit?
This is a question from Mr. Talabani about the Kurdish region. What progress is being made to unite the PUK and the KDP, the Peshmerga, the Asayesh forces? I know there's been a lot of discussions, a lot of talk, communication about it, but I was wondering if progress has been made. And if progress isn't made on that, do you feel that the Kurdish people will withdraw some of their support from the parties, do you see a long-term future for the parties as totally separate entities?
It's a very good question. It's a question that's being hotly discussed and debated in Kurdistan. There is now a process to, obviously, we unified the two administrations. There were several outstanding ministries that were not unified: Ministry of Justice, Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Peshmerga Affairs, and the Ministry of Finance. The Ministry of Justice was unified, and the court system was made independent of the government. The Ministry of Interior is in the process of being unified, and the Asayish and Security Services fall under the Ministry of Interior. So once that happens, we will then have a unified security force in the region. There is also talk and this is it's a two-way dialogue between the Kurds themselves and also with Baghdad as to putting the Peshmerga, the regional force of the Kurdistan region, under the command of the Kurdistan regional government and not under the command of the political party. So progress is being made on that. Some of it has to do with organizational structures vis-a-vis Kurdistan and Baghdad. Some of the debates that's been going on is as the Kurdistan region security forces are constantly called into battle outside of Kurdistan, that they should be paid by out of the federal budget, not out of the regional budget. So some of these issues are being held up in those discussions between Baghdad and Kurdistan. And yes, absolutely, if the situation doesn't develop, people will be upset, and we in Kurdistan want to show continual progress, and we are putting this as a sign of continual progress, as well as downsizing the cabinet that we have right now, which is way too big, and we have way too many civil servants. So these are highlights, priorities for us that we hope to tackle. I would think in the next administration, as elections will take place in Kurdistan in June of 2009, and it'll be difficult to get it done between now and June.
Is that fixed? The elections for June. Okay, thank you. Yes, please.
I'm Stephen Flecky with the Conference of Catholic Bishops. I was very impressed with these frequent appeals to the Constitution that were made in the panel. My question is around, I think it would be fair to say that there was uneven participation in the drafting of the Constitution, and particularly by Sunnis. And I'm just wondering what hope you see on the horizon, both for clarifying aspects of the Constitution, for assuaging Sunni concerns, and so that there would be both a process of clarification as well as perhaps some revisiting of some of the key tensions within the Constitution.
Thank you.
Certainly there is an amendment procedure. There was a commission that was established to make recommendations to make changes to the Constitution. Judge, you may have more insight on that. But it surprises us still that there hasn't been any serious or substantive recommendations put forth or adopted. And we hear arguments, for example, when we were trying to negotiate the hydrocarbons law, some of our colleagues in Baghdad that we were negotiating with said, well, we can't agree to this law because we may change the constitution and then this law won't reflect the constitution that we may have, and which was a baffling argument because you have a law that conforms to the constitution that you do have, not the one that you may have or the one that you wish you'd had. So we're not sure how serious, again, it comes back to how serious do people take the Constitution. If people take the Constitution seriously, and those that boycotted the constitutional process, again, they were not left out, they boycotted the process. They didn't take part in the elections, they missed out on the opportunity to have a say in the drafting and in the rebuilding of that country. They are given that chance to re-participate, and they have been since the Constitution was ratified. But again, I mean, if I was one of those people that felt that the Constitution didn't address my concerns, I'd be fighting tooth and nail to get on that table to have my issues addressed, to have reforms and changes made to the Constitution. The fact that there is
stagnation or real lack of interest or intent to make substantive changes to the Constitution, make us realize that many of these slogans that we hear are mainly political, to gather support, and are not genuine about the Constitution because they don't uphold it as the law of the land.
Judge Wright, would you?
Yeah, I want to ask something because, as you know, the Constitution is very important for Iraq, you know. And frankly, when people wrote the Constitution, they wrote it as a rush time that time. According to the Iraq Constitution now, we have 51 laws, you have to pass it. And also there is around 9 or 10 real problems, ethnicity, religious, and securities in the Constitution. For that reason, our strong recommendation to our colleagues there, don't pass any recommendation before we finish all this problem, to build a real draft to rewrite the Constitution, because we don't need to change the Constitution every day or every month or every year. We have to have stability, and the stability came from the Constitution. For that reason, the committees working now need some time to pass real draft recommendation.
Article 126 of the Constitution talks about the amendment process.
We will probably hear something more about the Constitution in the next panel. So I'm sure that topic will arise again. Yes, please.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Bryant. I'm a former Army officer who served in Iraq for 14 months during the 2004-2005 time frame. I was very pleased to hear you all speak about your concerns about corruption. I worked with a very good man named Waleed Keshmul, who was killed in 2005. He was the chief of the anti-corruption office in Mosul. My concern right now is that there's currently some very public calls in the Kurdistan region for helping solve the corruption in the Kurdistan regional government. And I wanted to ask either you, Mr. Provod, or you, Ms. Reen, what the Kurdistan regional government is doing to solve some of those corruption concerns.
I'm not sure if I'm authorized to announce this, but I'm going to do so anyway. We have entered into contractual agreements with several large and reputable firms to do a thorough review of our procurement procedures, our governing, let's say our governance, and our budgeting process. I think a lot of what is referred to as corruption in Kurdistan, and I don't say corruption doesn't exist, it does exist, but a lot of what is referred to as corruption in Kurdistan is actually just bad governance. It's mismanagement. And that we ourselves, when we're doing this reassessment, have to make to be able to distinguish between what is bad governance and what is just downright corruption. And once we can make that determination, we can fix bad governance where it's bad and root out corruption where it exists. We don't live in an isolated society anymore. What happens in Kurdistan gets picked up in the New York Times, gets picked up by Reuters, and our leaders understand that. And we have, I think, reacted positively to the pressure not only from our constituency, but also from our friends in the international community. As we better our governance, we'll limit the ability of people to benefit from their positions of power and be corrupt. But corruption is not an issue that can be addressed with one contract or with one policy or with one change of law, because corruption is something that's endemic from the top down to the average citizen. That citizen that gives the guard at the administrative office 10 dinars to be able to cut the line is as corrupt as the minister that gets a percentage of a contract. Mm-hmm. And that kind of issue is as much societal as it is matters of governance and greed. It requires a comprehensive strategy, one that is multifaceted, that is public, that is educational, that requires international assistance, and it requires a thorough self-reflection, of which I'm proud to say that the Kurdistan Regional Government has been doing and is continuing to do.
Ms. Jean, would you like to address that?
Just a general remark, and just to enforce the point that mentioned by Qubad, that corruption is not only administrative, it's social, it's societal. You know, unfortunately, in Iraq and even in Kurdistan, it's been used as a tool for political assassination, to bring down people, to sideline people. And then the other social aspect of it, people celebrate it. Like, they really expect people to give them, you know, benefits of that. So we have a real social issues to deal with, in addition to really pinpointing what is corruption. We still don't have that institutional knowledge yet to analyze and classify, and that's part of the chaos and the rumors and the bad reporting. It's all about rumors. It's all about envy. But of course there is corruption. The serious corruption is not being dealt with, and that's an issue that we all need to focus on, institutionalizing the anti-corruption instead of politicizing it.
Thank you.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Bob Dreyfus. I'm a journalist with The Nation magazine. And people who've been following the Middle East as long as I have remember when the Lebanese army in 1975, 76 kind of fell apart and became factionalized and ethnicized and so forth. And I wanted to ask people about Maliki and the Iraqi army. When I ask people in Washington as a reporter, you know, who makes up the army and what ethnic groups make up what units and who commands it and all that, it's kind of a mystery, a black box. Maybe intelligence people know, but I certainly don't know. So I wanted to ask a little bit about the, we're talking about institutions, about the army. And in particular, maybe Qubad, you could talk a little bit about who you meant by the little Saddam. It seemed like you meant Maliki, but maybe not. But people tell me he's trying to build himself up and use the army as the instrument of his power. So anyway, that's my question to the panel.
If Qubad mentioned, I can mention also, no problem. It's not people say that Mr. Maliki built himself as Saddam or say no. This report, it is last month from the some newspaper said that Maliki built a strong army and tried to build himself as a leader for the army. That's not true. That's constitution's issue. Who's the leader of the for all the armies in Iraq, and he's our prime minister, and we're proud of his job, frankly, and his result for the new democracy in Iraq. You know, this is democracy. Bring al-Maliki, and next year we'll bring him again, or bring another one, in same position. You know, because this position is came from the constitution. The prime minister, he's the head of the military guys. Also, I mentioned in my speech is. It's a problem to have big number as a military in Iraq. Again, you know, it's big problem there. But stability is very important. We need security and stability in Iraq to build our country. And everybody understands there is no stability without strong rule. Maybe this rule now is coming from the military, but I'm sure next 5 years we'll switch to the civil rule. And we'll switch to the rule of law again. Yeah.
Can I just add, before Qubad takes the political aspect of it, I will just talk about the institutional aspect of the Iraqi army. Having been in locations where liberated by the Iraqi army in Fallujah and Najaf, I saw Kurdish policemen, not Peshmerga, policemen working under an Arab Sunni or Shia general or commander in helping to restore peace and security in an area that is not Kurdish. So this is the kind of, the sense that I get for people working under the army.
I think in the northern divisions, there are certainly divisions where it's predominantly Kurdish force, but they're not totally Kurdish, and some of them, the commanders, are not Kurdish either. It is something that it's a work in progress, and I'm not sure how it is around the rest of the country. But it's only natural that you recruit, if you're building a division, stationing this division somewhere, that it's only natural that you raise and recruit that division from that area. Same with the police force. When you're building a police force, you want the police force to be local because they're going to know the streets, they're going to know the neighborhoods, and they're going to know the faces and the environment. A policeman from Najaf relocated to Mosul may feel a sense of personal, or somewhere else may feel a sense of personal unrest, but professionally he won't be able to do his job properly because he won't know how to get around. The Iraqi army is taking shape. It is going to be difficult to create this multi-ethnic army where people, you know, put Iraq first. We've had instances where Kurdish battalions have been sent into combat in non-Kurdish areas, and while they've been effective operationally, it has caused resentment from the local communities. This was most obviously prevalent in Fallujah, in what Ms. Barari was talking about. In Basra too, in the recent Basra offensive that was touted as a major success for Prime Minister Maliki. It was a major success for Prime Minister Maliki, but there were main forces that took part in that fight were Kurdish elements. But of course, this creates from nationalist sentiments, oh, Kurds are coming in, killing Arabs under American direction. This is something that we have to live with. We have to ignore these kinds of sentiments and keep doing what we feel is the right thing. On the issue of the Prime Minister being the commander-in-chief of the army, yes, he is the commander-in-chief of the army, but there are also institutions in place that prevent him from doing things based on his own personal will or emotion. This recent issue with Khanaqin, where Iraqi army units were sent to Khanaqin, was done so without the head of the Iraqi army knowing about it, the head of the general staff knowing about it. This is where you talk about institutions. This is a total lack of regard and respect for institutions that we are proud of standing up in Iraq. This cannot be allowed to happen. And thankfully, the issue was diffused and it didn't get out of hand. And to touch, Mr. Dreyfus, on your question about the Little Saddam, I wasn't just referring to Maliki. I was referring to the weakness in people. When you put so much power, so much wealth, so much authority in the hands of one person, one ministry, or one entity, it's only natural for that person to suddenly feel that this power could overcome them, that this power can overtake them, and that they can suddenly be bigger than themselves, and they start being, going beyond confident into arrogant, which eventually leads to dictatorships. And that's what we're afraid of. That's why from day one we have tried to put in place checks and balances. It's why from day one we wanted to, when we started building the Iraqi army, put in place provisions that if a unit is mobilized, that its logistics team has to be authorized by somebody else. And there were many complicated procedures that were, again, great in PowerPoint presentations, and when we were talking about them, looked really good. But again, we have not seen the full implementation of those institutions and procedures that we set up. And sorry, sir, I forgot your name that you served in Iraq. I want to thank you for your service, for your country and for ours as well. I forgot to do that earlier, and I apologize.
Well, thank you very much. I think we have to close the questions for this panel. We're already overshot our time. Hopefully, if there are any questions remaining for this panel, perhaps Dan will give us a little time. I think we're going to have a break now. Do we have a two-minute break? I bow to greater authority. Yes.
If you say two, it'll be 20.
A two-minute break.
Bad seeing even you. You don't want to give up your seat.
Let me come around.
Test 1-2, test 1-2.
Test it. Power, yes. You don't want to give it up.
لا
على الريبورت ممتاز. انا ذاك بروح على الدوره عليها. شكرا جزيلا.